I'm here with Dr. Scott Borma, and we're here to talk about a joint concert by the University Concert Band and the University Symphonic Band on Sunday. Welcome back to WMUK.
Thank you. Great to be here.
You were just telling me about your weekend, and I almost understood where you were and what you were doing, but I think it's interesting to hear about some of the activities you are involved in that contribute to what you bring to the School of Music at Western.
Yeah, well, I kind of, in my alter world, also compose music and arrange music. And this past weekend, I happened to have design meetings for an ensemble that I write for called the Madison Scouts. They're a drum and bugle corps out of Madison, Wisconsin. And I've been writing for them since the late 80s. So,
why are
long
they called
time.
Design meetings?
Well, because we'll get together a team of different specialists that put together the show. We'll have the director of the ensemble, then we'll have the program coordinator who kind of is in charge of taking all the elements and fashioning a show out of it. Then I will be the person that would write all the wind music. It kind of starts with me. I write the arrangements for the ensemble. Then we have two people who write the percussion music that enhance it, and we work pretty jointly during the process to make sure that it's a well-integrated musical production. Then we'll have a person that writes the drill, all the movement that you see on the field for. It's like a professional marching band. It's the best way I can describe it. But they rehearse one weekend every month throughout the winter, and then they live together through the entire summer and travel the nation, sometimes internationally, performing all over. And so it's a pretty serious kind of thing. We also have a person that writes all of the flag work and rifle line work that comes together. And so we spend a lot of time on Skype, and sometimes when we're able to get together and physically talk about it, that's what I was doing this weekend.
I'm sure that being director of bands at Western probably employs you full-time plus.
Oh, yeah.
But is this just one of those things that's just don't want to set aside?
Well, it's my creative outlet. Yeah. You know, it's what I do. You know, some professors write papers and research and publish articles and books and things like that. I write music and publish music. And so that's just kind of my... It goes along with my job as a professor at the university, but it's something that I've always done anyway.
It goes along with it. Does it help it in any way?
I think so. Yeah. I think as somebody who spends most of his time rehearsing ensembles and studying the scores in preparation for those rehearsals and performances, I think as a composer myself, as an arranger myself, it gives me a unique, hopefully deep, perceptive look at what the composer might have been thinking and why he or she crafted the notes in the way that he did. And so I think it helps me to get deeper into the score, maybe faster than people that don't have that experience.
When I talked to the piano virtuoso Marc-André Hamelin last month, I think it was, I was asking him all about what was going on in Schubert's life and Mozart's life, and he just stopped me there and said, you know, you can get so much more just looking at the notes on the page, at the score itself. It mm-hmm. tells you so much.
Yep.
And then he went on to say that as a composer, he had written a piece for himself to play, and then it was assigned in a competition to four other players. And he had to change. Like,
yeah.
He went back and changed some things.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Based on that. So this fidelity to score and understanding how to read a score is so critical.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's different than being, you know, a flutist in the band who just I just learned my part. It must be a whole different language to you.
Well, and it's interesting you should say that, because we right now in our symphonic band rehearsals are spending a great deal of our time just talking about getting outside your part. You know, I think it's very easy for an individual player in an ensemble, especially a really large ensemble, to heighten their awareness of what's happening around them beyond what's on their page. And that's when you truly get an ensemble that it's successful, when you have musicians that are able to be integrated into the whole sonic spectrum beyond what they're trying to do individually.
Well, you've got the sometimes dreaded word Schoenberg on your program.
Bum, bum, bum.
So I would think that having an understanding of what everyone else is doing is a great, great thing to use in this case.
Yeah, definitely.
But give us the big picture about when and where and why.
Well, this Sunday, 3 o'clock p.m. in Miller Auditorium, it's a free concert. Come on out. We've got our university symphonic band and concert band both playing a joint concert. The concert band will begin with three of their pieces, and then we'll perform four of our pieces. And it's just a lot of variety. I think that's one thing about going to a concert band, quote-unquote concert band concert, is that there's just a lot of variety in the kind of music you'll hear. We have music from a lot of different eras. We have music that was written last week compared to music that's, you know, an arrangement of something from the Renaissance period, and music from composers of different nationalities. And and it's interesting when the conductor of the concert band is Dr. David Montgomery, my dear colleague, and when we put this concert together, we oftentimes don't know what the other is thinking about possibly programming, and and sometimes we try to coordinate it into one kind of a theme. Several years ago, we did a Bach theme where every piece in some way related to Bach, but sometimes we just say we're going to do these pieces and see how they work together, and this year was kind of that way. And interestingly enough, we both chose as the opening of each of our performances a Spanish composer, and just kind of a surprise that they're completely different sounding pieces, but by Spanish composers. It's kind of fascinating how that works out sometimes.
The concert band begins with a Joaquin Turina piece arranged by Alfred Reed, who's one of the great statesmen of wind music, the La Procesión du Rocío.
Yeah, nice.
From 1913, Turina being one of the sort of Spanish new wave.
Yeah, right, exactly. And as you said, this was arranged by Alfred Reed, so this was originally written for orchestra, but I've never heard of an orchestra playing it, frankly. It's, for some reason, the band transcription is the one that gets played, and maybe it speaks to people for some reason as a wind percussion work. But it was originally performed by an orchestra, and it's inspired by a religious festival that happens every year in Turina, which is the hometown of Sevilla, Spain. Every year in Sevilla during the month of June, there's a section of the city known as Triana, which is an ancient gypsy quarter of the town, and they have this festival called the Procession of the Dew, which is the translation, D-E-W. And the families of the city participate in this. They make their entry into the finest coaches, following an image of the Virgin Mary on a golden cart drawn by an oxen, accompanied by bands and music. So it's a big, big celebration. There is a lot of variety in what happens in the parade, and that comes across in the music.
From there, there's a piece called Elegy for a Young American, and the date next to it is 1964. So would it be a good guess to assume that this composer was honoring JFK?
Way to go. Kara, you're on it. Yes, absolutely. This is all about the reaction to Kennedy and his assassination. And obviously an elegy in his honor. And it goes through, he described it as going through all the various stages of emotions during the grief process. So there's sadness, there's angst, there's anger, there's just a wide variety of really passionate emotions. It's a really beautiful piece. It was very popular when it was written in the 60s, and that was a time where band conductors were very much wanting the repertoire to build, and so we had more good pieces written for band. And so when this came out, it just got played a lot for a couple decades, and we don't hear it a whole lot. Just like anything else, there are so many composers that are writing for the wind ensemble these days that we now are amassing this great repertoire, and so this kind of sometimes gets buried, but I was really happy that Dr. Montgomery chose to bring it out. It's being conducted by one of our graduate students, John Leonard.
Very good. This was written by Ronald Lowe Presti, and the final work on the first half of the concert, featuring the University Concert Band, is by Robert Jager.
Yes.
Is he an American composer?
Yep. He was born in New York and a graduate of the University of Michigan, and I served in the United States Navy as the staff arranger and composer at the Armed Forces School of Music, and taught for a lot of years, and he lives in Tennessee.
And the piece is called Esprit de Corps.
Yeah, it was written for, it's based on the Marines hymn, and it was it's kind of a fantasy march, and it's written as a tribute to the United States Marine Band. It was commissioned by John Bourgeois, who was the conductor of the Marine Band at the time, and it's kind of an homage to John Bourgeois. He's a dramatic and spirited conductor, and the piece, actually, the opening tempo is written at tempo de bourgeois, which just typically means lively and full of energy.
Again, this concert is Sunday at 3 o'clock in Miller Auditorium. It's free and open to the public. Joint concert by the University Concert Band and University Symphonic Band, which is an annual event when you come together. So now we're going to start the second half with the University Symphonic Band and another Spanish composer. Tell me about Luis Alarcón.
Yes, yeah, fascinating composer who's writing a lot of music for winds and percussion these days, getting a lot of attention for his music. And this piece, Duende, was written in 2010, and the following year it received the award for the best publication of a classical piece from the National Music Awards. It's big time. And that's not just published classical band piece, that's published classical piece. So it's a pretty big deal. It's a four-movement work. We're only doing the fourth movement of it. It just is a great concert opener. It starts with this just awesome flamenco groove and hand clapping, and you feel like you're on the streets of Sevilla. And it's a really, really fascinating work. A lot of energy. The word duende is used in flamenco to refer to a state of inspiration and supreme perceptiveness, almost magic, which is only reached by the performer in few occasions. Composer says in his program notes, the use of the word duende as the title of this collection of symphonic preludes, independently of its poetic significance, is based on the fact that I found my principal inspiration for this composition in the Spanish popular music. Listening to the piece, the listener can hear, among other features, the symphonic energy of De Falla's scores, the intimacy of Iberia by Albinis, the magic of the guitar played by Tomatito or Paco de Lucia, the festive happiness of Granadan Sacromonte, popular flamenco neighborhood in Granada. But especially insist in this one, the obvious presence of winks to other musical styles such as jazz or Latin music.
A lot of influences.
Yes.
From a composer to keep an eye on, clearly.
Yes, absolutely.
Luis Alarcón. Here's the fourth movement of Duende. You brought it along, Scott. Thank you for that. And the concert again, Sunday at 3 o'clock in Miller Auditorium. That's a very exciting piece called Duende, or the final movement of Duende, Tempo de Bulería, by Luis Alarcón. And my guest here, who will hopefully take over pronouncing duties from now on, is Scott Borma, who will conduct that piece. It's the beginning of the second half of Sunday's program with the University Concert Band in the first half and the Symphonic Band in the second half. Everything you said describing it was quite accurate, not over exaggerated there.
That's a wonderful piece, and it's just rhythmically incredibly demanding. It goes back and forth from 6/8 time and 3/4 time, depending on what part you're playing. And as a conductor, it's a challenge to choose which to be in to benefit the players the most, because some parts are directly in 1-2-3, 1-2-3, and some parts are in 1-2-dup-dup-dup-dup, and to kind of reconcile that and make sure that I'm giving them everything they need to to feel comfortable about it. It's been a good challenge for us.
How many students on stage for this?
65 in the symphonic band and probably about 75 for the concert band.
So you open with this, and how do you... Let's talk about the next piece. What happens?
Well, then we're going into Respighi, who's, of course, most known for his three pieces, Fountains of Rome, The Pines of Rome, and Roman Festivals. Just fantastic composer. This piece was written in 1932, and so it was a late piece in his life. He died when he was in 1936, but this was written for winds. It was dedicated to Edwin Frankel Goldman, big name in the band world, and the American Bandmasters Association. They actually commissioned the piece from Respighi for a special concert in memory of John Philip Sousa, and he had just passed away in March of that year. And so Hunting Tower received its premiere at that concert on April 17th in 1932. And incidentally, so did Holst's Hammersmith, another big-time band work.
Landmark piece.
By a major composer. So it was quite a concert to have those pieces premiered.
You'll have to tell me why he titled it Hunting Tower.
Yeah, there's a castle in Scotland called Hunting Tower Castle. And so his inspiration came from a visit to that castle. And he visited it years before he did the composition, but for some reason it kind of stuck with him and something that he wanted to write about. And it's just a varied portrait of his views of the place. It begins and ends with slow, gloomy, dotted figures and explores mysterious, heroic, and romantic themes. And I guess there's a legend of the Hunting Tower Castle about Lady Greensleeves, and I won't get into the long story. My graduate student, Laura Zilhaver, is conducting the work, and so she knows more about the story than I do. But it's just very romantic, very inspiring wind music.
When you have a standalone piece with a literary or artistic additional component to it, the structure can go soft, loud, soft, or loud, soft, loud. Is that something he uses, a structure that makes sense narratively?
Yeah, I think so. It definitely starts very foreboding and dark, and you can almost see the mists of the land of Scotland and just kind of emerging out of it is this castle, and at some point it ramps up and goes faster with more fanfaric brass figures, but then it returns to the more solemn music. So I think it's very programmatic, and you can, it's almost like movie music in a way. It describes a landscape.
From 1932, music of Ottorino Respighi. Let's take a break and hear music from Hunting Tower. Inspired by a castle in Scotland, we heard Hunting Tower, written by Ottorino Respighi, introduced to me by my guest, Dr. Scott Borma, director of bands at Western Michigan University and the director of the University Symphonic Band. Your graduate assistant, Laura Zilhaver, will be conducting that piece, which sounds like quite a challenge.
It is a challenging piece to conduct. It's been great to see her progress through that, and she's done a wonderful job.
What year is Ms. Zilhaver in?
Yeah, she's in her second year, so assuming all goes well, she will be a master of music come May. And she's very busy with all of her many graduate assistant duties.
Is she a Michigan native, or
no,
did she join us from somewhere?
She did her undergrad at Baldwin-Wallace Conservatory, and so this Michigan is new to her. So she's really been enjoying her time here at Western.
Well, she's preparing that piece, but you have to be prepared for three other pieces. We've already looked at the Spanish and sort of Roma-influenced Alarcón piece. Then comes the one I sort of, we went dun-dun-dun earlier. This is a set of variations by Arnold Schoenberg.
Right. It's a name you don't necessarily associate with band music.
Right.
People who may not know the name Arnold Schoenberg, he's most famous for his serialist music, his 12-tone music. And there was a big movement in the middle of the 20th century, or early middle 20th century, of writing completely atonal music, a complete denial of tonality. And by tonality, I mean music returning to a bass, like the pieces in B-flat. We no longer have pieces in B-flat. We have music that purposely tries to avoid having any tonal center that returns. So it's all completely grounded in the technique, the contrapuntal techniques of the composition, and not so much about traditional ways of returning to sounds.
Right. But he replaced our understanding of tonal writing with a different system. It's not chance. It's not random.
Right.
Entirely. It is a...
highly organized.
Yes.
Yeah, he would take 12 notes and put them in a certain order, and throughout the entire piece stayed religiously exactly in that order.
Yeah.
Every note would be followed always by the next note, followed always by the next note. Of course, you'd have chords that would play. You'd get five of those notes played once and then go on to the next note. Sometimes he would do it backward. He would do, invert it. He would retrograde inversion, and he'd take this row and put it in, like, if it started with B, maybe he'd start in with the F, but it'd be the same intervals that he'd go through. So extremely highly organized, and it really dominated the compositional landscape in the middle of the 20th century. Composers, student composers, were pretty much required to write 12-tone music. It was just, if you didn't write 12-tone music, you just weren't a serious composer. And a lot of composers now who have returned to more tonal, romantic-influenced music bemoan all those years that they were required to write this kind of music. It is a very important movement, and it was a very important evolution in our compositional process to explore those options. And there's some wonderful, beautiful music that's written in that style.
It actually produced some masterpieces.
Yeah, but it really takes a dedication and a patience to appreciate it. So Schoenberg, early in his life, if you hear some of his earlier music, you might think you're listening to Wagner or Mahler. It's just gorgeous, romantic music. Verklär te Nacht is like just gorgeous. And then he returned to more romantic styles, and he always still respected traditional disciplines. And he's famously quoted as saying, "There's still much good music to be written in C major." He just wasn't doing it. When anti-Semitism swept across Europe in the 30s, he actually emigrated to America and moved to sunny Southern California. And I think he chilled out a little bit and started writing a little bit more tonal music again, and theme and variations.
He was sort of associated in Hollywood and teaching a lot of those composers who would go on to write film music.
Right, yep.
And California is sort of a C major sort of state.
Right, absolutely. Well, this piece that we're going to be playing was originally written for wind band, and it's called Theme and Variations, and it's his Opus 43, and was written in 1943. And they call this Schoenberg's American period. And he was asked by his American publisher, G. Schirmer Incorporated, to write the piece. They asked him to write the piece. And at that time, 1943, there weren't a lot of big-time composers writing for wind band. And so it was a time where there was a big movement to start getting very important composers to write for this medium. And so this is the result of one of those attempts.
I seem to recall an outdoor overture by Copland. Is this a similar
absolutely.
Composition?
And shortly to follow, Paul Hindemith's Symphony in B-flat, and a lot of really respected composers started kind of getting urged to try this. And so this was his go at it. And at that time, most band music, people would hope that high school bands would play it because they'd get a lot of play, but this was definitely too hard for high school bands. So he actually wrote, he transcribed it for orchestra. And so, unfortunately, the first premiere wasn't in its original form. The first premiere happened by the Boston Symphony in 1944, and then the original version was finally premiered by the Goldman Band, by Richard Franco Goldman, who was a conductor, in 1946. So a few years later, it finally got its premiere. But it's as you would expect from Schoenberg, highly chromatic. It's just really astoundingly chromatic. It's definitely one of the more difficult pieces in the repertoire, and but it starts in G minor and it ends in G major.
Again, the concert is this Sunday. To hear the symphonic band and the concert band in concert at Miller Auditorium, it's 3 o'clock and the concert is free. Let's hear music of Arnold Schoenberg. I'm enjoying very much hearing the theme and variations by Arnold Schoenberg. And we just faded out of one of the variations in the middle. You'll have to be in attendance on Sunday to hear the complete set of Arnold Schoenberg Variations for Wind Band, Opus 43A. My guest is Scott Borma, if you just tuned in. And Dr. Scott Borma is director of bands at Western Michigan University and has programmed this truly intriguing piece. Mm-hmm. It also sounds like there's a great deal of humor.
Yeah, definitely.
Too, and all the techniques they're using.
Yep.
Share what you said one of the players was saying to you about their experience of playing it.
Well, most of the players in the ensemble for this work are playing one on a part. He wrote for a lot of different wind instruments. For instance, there are two trumpets, there are two cornets, there are two flugelhorns. And it's kind of that way throughout the whole entire ensemble. So all of the students are playing their own part. They're not doubling with other players. And a lot of students have commented to me, especially some of the graduate students, that they just feel like this is one piece that they've played where they feel like their part is integral at all the time. They never feel like they're playing an accompaniment role. Everything they play has a significant place in the texture. And that's a really insightful, true statement. It's just, it's so complex, but he's so masterfully orchestrated it to be that there's nothing wasted. It's everything there has a purpose of propelling the music along. It's just really fascinating. And it concludes with this wonderful, big, ominous ending. And this motive, da da dee da 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 dee da da. So he's constantly shifting between major-ish and minor-ish tonalities and can't quite decide where he wants to go, but ends up ending in a major G chord. And that little motive there kind of inspired the next piece on the concert. Not only is Schoenberg's piece a theme in variations, he takes one theme that he gives at the beginning and puts it through all kinds of different tests along the way to the final conclusion. Well, the next piece by Donald Grantham, Fantasy Variations on George Gershwin's Piano Prelude No. 2, is a little bit different. It's also a set of variations, but he never really tells you what the theme is first. It's like he does all of his variations on a theme, and then finally in the end it comes together, oh, there's that theme.
Oh.
But because it's a...
I mean, the Enigma variations are on a hidden theme.
Right.
That is never explained.
Right. Yeah. No, you definitely get it with the Grantham at the end. But it's a very famous, based on a prelude by George Gershwin that you may or may not know. But if you hear it, it's like, I probably have heard that someplace. And it was a set of three piano preludes written in 1936. It's Gershwin's only solo work for piano. And it's been really popular for a lot of years. And oddly enough, in the program notes, it talks about how even as severe a composer as Arnold Schoenberg found it intriguing enough to orchestrate. So Schoenberg has orchestrated this piano prelude before. And so, all these kind of tie-ins made out, I got to play these two pieces, and they're nothing alike. But they have these connections. And,
is there a more famous piece by Donald Grantham that really put him on the map?
Probably Southern Harmony is his biggest, most famous piece for wind ensemble. He writes for a lot of genres, but he's probably best known for his band music. And Southern Harmony is a big one. Jet au bal I probably mispronounced, my French is terrible. Kentucky Harmony is another piece, but he's really prolific. He's written so many pieces for the medium. But this particular piece got a lot of attention.
Fantasy Variations from 1998.
Right.
Very new. On the Gershwin Prelude No. 2 for piano. This is the slow prelude, right?
Yes, it is. Yeah. And also, blues. I was going to say, it starts with this bum, tum, 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 kind of a feel in the piano, which also relates to the Schoenberg, that final motive that happens in the Schoenberg. But it's just this lovely melody, and at the end of his version of it, well, I shouldn't even say his version of it, his take on these variations, that theme finally comes back to its full fruition after going through a big swing section and lots of kind of Broadway-ish kind of feels to it. Like I was saying on the break during the Schoenberg, it's one of the hardest pieces I think I've ever done with any ensemble in my career. It's hard for the players. It's hard for the conductor. It's just really highly integrated. And I say that every time I do a Donald Grantham piece, that it always seems like it's not going to be as hard as it is, but it's always hard.
Well, I don't think you could have given a better overview and introduction to brand new pieces to listeners on WMUK. I hope the concert on Sunday goes really, really well.
Thank you.
And that WMUK will have a chance to share the music down the line, the live performances that are recorded. So any final thoughts?
No, just come on out. 3:00. It's a free concert. A lot of variety, fun music. I think you'll really enjoy it.
Well, thank you, Scott.
Thank you.